You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. Please continue to help spread the word that this show brings on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And remember, if you can't listen live, go to our website at answers.network and browse through a variety of heartfelt topics. I also ask a favor of you, so please forward one of our shows to your social media groups and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive influence on the world. And I gotta tell you, the subject is going to be happiness, so we all know somebody that can benefit from this. But our topic today is burnout from that happiness. So even before COVID, burnout in our healthcare professionals was already on the rise. Since COVID, I can't even imagine where it's at now. This is a problem we cannot afford to ignore. Healthcare professionals sacrifice their health, their happiness, and their relationships. Unfortunately, there is a solution. Our guest created Gain Without Pain so that healthcare professionals can prevent burnout and reclaim their happiness. So our guest, which is Dr. Greg Hammer, he's a professor at Stanford University School of Medicine, a pediatric intensive care physician, a pediatric anesthesiologist, and he addresses this issue right up front with his new book, Gain Without Pain, The Happiness Handbook for Healthcare Professionals, which I think is a happiness health book for everybody. So Dr. Hammer is a member of the Stanford Wellness Initiative. He is currently the chair of the Physician Wellness Task Force for the California Society of Anesthesiologists. He has been a visiting professor and lecturer on wellness at institutions worldwide. Now, he researches in the developmental pharmacology and immunology field, and he has an active laboratory with multiple ongoing studies in these areas. Dr. Hammer is also a health enthusiast and meditator himself, utilizing a non-duality and mindfulness-based approach, including the GAIN method. Dr. Hammer, welcome to Answers Network.
Wonderful to be with you, Alan.
Well, it is my pleasure. And before we talk so much about the book, share a little bit about yourself and how you found yourself working in medicine and then realizing the issues that are there for burnout in other healthcare professionals.
I really was interested as a child in astronomy, and I thought that would be my career. I did, in fact, study astronomy as an undergraduate. I was really captivated by the relationship between the very, very small and the infinite, the interrelationship of all things and how systems were formed and related to one another on an increasingly large scale. And I came to a fork in the road where I had to decide whether I wanted to pursue astronomy or another topic I was interested in, which was human biology. And I was interested in human biology largely for the same reasons, because, you know, we have our subcellular components that make up cells, and cells, of course, make up tissues, and tissues make up organs, and organs make up the body, more or less. And so, again, we have this micro to macro interrelationship, which I find very poetic and beautiful. So as Yogi Berra said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. I took the fork toward human biology and decided to go to medical school. And I found a kinship with people who work with children. I just found them to be more like me. Not that I, at that point, felt that I was devoted to children, but I like the other people in pediatric medicine. They didn't take themselves quite so seriously, more of a sense of humor, and a little bit more humility, which I think attracts me. And so while I was a pediatric resident, I really fell in love with the intensive care unit. At that time, doing anesthesiology in combination with pediatric critical care was a good way to go. So I did a second residency in anesthesiology, fellowship training in pediatric anesthesiology and critical care. And I've done that ever since and never looked back. I've been at Stanford since 1995. I've developed a great research career in my laboratory. And throughout all this time, I really maintained my interest in the continuity of everything. And that's a sort of a cosmologic principle. And I've coupled that with my longstanding interest in fitness, physical and spiritual fitness. I've been a long time exercise enthusiast. My undergraduate degree actually ended up being in nutritional science, and that's very important in my critical care practice and my personal life. So I think things kind of came to a beautiful synthesis for me. I feel very fortunate. Stanford formed an organization called WellMD several years ago, and that was really in response to the growing prevalence, or not to use a term that's applicable to COVID, but really a pandemic of burnout in the medical professions. So Stanford formed this WellMD program. I hopped on board, and things kind of went from there. I was asked to give a talk on wellness at a national meeting, and then one thing led to another, and that avenue sort of took a life of its own on. And so I've maintained my clinical practice and my research interest and activities, but I've become more and more committed to spreading the message about wellness. And I can say that I really did begin to experience burnout myself. And I guess we should define burnout. I would define it as emotional and physical exhaustion that is a result of chronic stress. So we can talk about various aspects of chronic stress, which we all deal with inside and outside medicine. And I think the COVID pandemic has really kind of put many of us over the edge with regard to the effects of chronic stress on our sleep, our exercise, our nutrition, and our emotional and spiritual well-being. So at this point in my career, I'm really all about kind of spreading this message, which I think is a component of the solution to burnout.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that that I was drawn to when my producer brought your book to my attention and I started going through it was, first of all, I felt a synergy because, you know, I believe our mind and body are so deeply connected, and that every thought that we have has a direct cellular effect on our bodies. So I started thinking about it, and when we set it an intention, how do the communication pathways between our mind, brain, and body actually fire up? And how can we control this to change our brain for life?
That is one of the central questions. I think you've kind of framed that beautifully, Alan. There is a lot of evidence that our brains are wired in certain ways, and that we have this quality called neuroplasticity. That means that we can actually change the way our brains function. A couple of ways in which our brains have become wired, and, you know, we could talk about the teleologic or evolutionary stimuli for the way our brains work, but there are two ways our brains work that I think tend to veil our ability to be present and happy. And they are, first of all, we all have a negativity bias. Mm-hmm. We tend to remember the negative things and forget about the positive things. I don't know whether you've read the book, but there's a wonderful example of that. And again, I appreciate your comment that the book really applies to everyone, and I think that it does. But the stories are largely based, you know, around medicine and medical practice. But that, you know, I think most everyone can relate to them. But I do tell the story regarding the negativity bias of a day I spent with one of my trainees, one of my pediatric anesthesia fellows, and we had four very difficult cases in the operating room, and all of them involved a lot of procedures that she and I did, inserting catheters in arteries and veins and breathing tubes and epidural catheters and so on. And she did everything flawlessly in all of the patients, except she had trouble getting the arterial catheter in one patient, so I stepped in to do that. But all the patients woke up comfortable, and she really did an outstanding job. We debriefed at the end of the day. I congratulated her on an excellent day. I later found out from her through discussions the following day that she went home. She had a dinner with her spouse, and as she was preparing to go to sleep at night, she was taking stock of the day. And did she think of all the wonderful things that she had done well, and how wonderfully her patients did, how comfortable they were, how stable they were? No, she thought about the one arterial catheter that she couldn't get in. And so I had to step in and do that. And so of all the things that she should have been very proud of and had a very positive memory of, she picked the one really small thing. I mean, we all miss these procedures sometimes. And I say jokingly to my trainees, yeah, that happened to me once back in the 90s. Of course, it's happened to me many times. Whatever it is, I mean, we've all missed things on a first attempt. But in any case, that just emphasizes our negativity bias. She took the one thing that she considered negative, and she was very hard on herself and thought about that before she went to sleep. So that's an excellent example of our negativity bias. And the other property we have, Alan, is that we're fixated on the past and the future. And really, if you think about all the happy moments that you've had, they are when you're completely present. You're walking through a forest, you're marveling at the tall trees, the sunlight filtering through the canopy above. You're not really thinking about what happened yesterday or the list of things you might have to do next week. You're really right there, and that is when you're happy. And why do we have so much trouble being present? Well, we do. We all do. We all tend to overthink the past and future. When we overthink the past, it generates shame and self-criticism. And when we overthink the future, we generate fear and anxiety. And this is how all of our brains work. So first of all, to everyone listening, don't feel as though you are alone, that you alone are very harshly critical of yourself and have these habits of thinking of negative things and fixating on the past and future. We all are wired that way. The good news is, by having positive thoughts and by directing our thoughts to the present moment, little by little, we can rewire our brains through this neuroplasticity quality that we all have. So we should all be happy about that, and we can certainly talk more about that.
Well, and I've heard different studies where they've said that the positive versus negative that stays with us is 7 to 1 or 10 to 1 as far as what we focus on. It sounds like what you're saying is that we can chip away at that. Is that what I hear you saying? We can chip away at that and make it a little closer, try to get to that one-on-one, you know, to where it, I think it would allow us to make better decisions without having this kind of 10 to 1 of negativity working on our brain. I think one of the more unfortunate things is that I think on a bigger level, I think you have large media companies, you have, political processes that have learned about this. And so they focus on it, which I think makes it even worse. They continue to feed us this because their studies have shown they can get more for their buck by taking that negative path. Do you agree with that?
I do think that, you know, marketing strategies out there in the commercial world often kind of prey on our weaknesses, and directly and indirectly. I mean, even by just simply portraying the human body as this perfectly thin, muscular, lean, athletic creation.
Right.
We see that, and then our negativity bias kicks in, and we criticize ourselves for not measuring up to that image. So that may be a way in which they're indirectly capitalizing on our negativity bias and our self-judgment. But yes, I think there are also more direct ways as well.
You know, I've mentioned, you mentioned about the pathways or the neuroplasticity in our brain. And I like to do things very simply. So I spoke one time about this, having this vision of our brain as a snow-capped mountain. And we get off the lift and we keep taking the same route down the mountain. So we've created a groove. So now every time we pop off, we kind of fall into that groove and then we keep going. And so I'm thinking that we need two things. We need, one is we need it to continue to snow to fill that. But on the other hand, we need to force ourselves sometimes to take a new path, start a new groove or a new path. And I think if we look at it that way, to where that new path is positive, we're going to start, say, with gratitude, and we're going to be, like you were saying about that example, if she can start out by focusing on, wow, I had 10 patients today and I made all of them better. That's the bottom line to this thing, as opposed to, wow, on one of them, I had a little trouble with something, and making that the thing that can keep you from falling asleep.
I like that analogy of the skiing. I would maybe add to it that that well-groomed, well-traveled path leads to a tree. It's not only that you're doing the same thing over and over again when there's all these other beautiful routes you might be taking, but in fact, that path leads you to something negative, mm-hmm. and yet you keep doing it. And so I do think that's an excellent example. And yes, there's work to be done, or an activation energy, we might say, in creating a new path. And the good news is, if we commit to that little by little, so I think we should set our expectations that we didn't get here overnight. We're not going to change that ski path overnight or in one session. It took us a long time to get here. And what we need to do is just make even the tiniest bit of progress on a daily basis. So I'm a big proponent of a daily practice. I think, we are too oriented toward relying on that vacation every 4 to 6 months or whatever to refresh us, and of mm-hmm. course we all know that it takes a few days to start to wind down, and then it takes a while to wind down, but it doesn't take very long to wind back up. So when we get back to work, pretty much by the end of the day, the benefits of that week off seem to have vanished. So instead, I would really propose that we have a daily practice and remind ourselves to set the bar very low. There's no such thing as failure. Even if we spend as little as 3 minutes focusing on what I think are the four pillars of spiritual and emotional well-being, which are expressed in the acronym GAIN, mm-hmm. we can have a 3-minute GAIN meditation or contemplation in the morning. And the more we do this, the more we start to form those new pathways. And there's an expression that neurons that fire together wire together. So as we're creating these new thoughts and these new patterns, we're actually causing them to be progressively more well embedded into our neuronal network, if you will. So it's just baby steps. This is how we learn. And a consistent approach, and I would say a daily practice. And it's actually, I like that you think of things in simple analogies and maybe frame things simply, Alan. I likewise do that. And I think that applies very well to this practice. It's very simple.
Well, when we're talking about, you mentioned baby steps, and I think a lot of us will go in with the greatest of intentions, or we will set goals. One of the things, and I know you touch on it in the book, is what is the difference between intentions and goals?
Goals are more or less long-term proposals we make to ourselves. And intention is something that is happening right now. And so in the book, I tell a story about a Saturday afternoon. It's a beautiful day here in Northern California, and decide to go for a bike ride up in the hills. So I take my bike off the rack in my garage and have my gear on, and I'm pedaling up the road, and I start to climb. And my goal is to get to the top of this ridge of hills that separates where I live on Stanford campus, or basically Palo Alto, and the Pacific Ocean. So cycling up to the top of that ridge, which is called Skyline, one can even have a view of the Pacific Ocean on a relatively clear day. And so my goal is to make it to the top of Skyline and enjoy the beautiful vistas out toward the Pacific Ocean. My intention is to be present during the ride so that I'm in touch with the way my muscles feel, even the bit of lactic acid that's accumulating with each rotation of the pedals. I'm taking in the beautiful surroundings on my way up to the top of Skyline. Those are my intentions. Those are applicable right now, each moment of the ride. And let's face it, in our experience, all we have is a moment.
Right.
The past and the future just represent a series of thoughts. So my intention is to be present in that only moment we ever truly experience. And my goal is to make it to the top and see the Pacific Ocean. So I enjoy the ride. I'm fulfilling my intentions. It's beautiful. I feel free. I feel elated. But by the time I get to the top, the fog has rolled in, as it tends to do in this area, and I can barely see 100 feet ahead of me. Forget about the Pacific Ocean. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, I have not achieved my goal, but I fulfilled my intention along the way. And I'm perfectly happy and satisfied and ready to hang out for a bit, catch my breath, and head back. And that's an example of the difference between intentions right now and goals, which are off in the future. And I think the problem with being goal-oriented and not living each moment, each day with intention is, and there's nothing wrong with having goals by any means, but when those supplant or take the place of or preclude having intentions, focusing on intentions, we tend to live our lives at arm's length. You know, we always have a goal that's off in the future. And this is another way that we tend to think. If I do these things now, especially in medicine, I think, because you sort of, you know, put the gratification off in the future. Well, if I do this, I'll get into a good college. If I do this in college, I'll get into medical school. If I get into medical school and do this, I'll get a good residency, and then I'll get a good fellowship, and then I'll have the career that I want. The problem is, and that's all fine, but if that occurs at the expense of, or rather a lack of intention along the way, then we've gone through 4, 8, 12, 15 years of sort of putting off our enjoyment for some future goal. And this, again, these neurons that are only goal-oriented and not intention-oriented are becoming well entrenched in the way our brains work after these years of thinking in that way. And pretty soon, we're only able to really think about long-term goals. And we've bypassed the enjoyment of the present moment through intention.
We have some listener questions that have come in. And again, I want to thank those that take the time. Some of which are our teachers, actually, that we find a lot of them will send things in because the show's in the middle of the day. So they'll send in questions like the night before or something, and then they'll listen later on this evening to the answers. One listener question comes in that says, I seem to find myself going through a letdown when I achieve a goal that I have set and worked very hard to achieve. What can I do to be able to rejoice and maintain that feeling longer than I have been as of late?
Beautiful question. And I should tell you, Alan, that I'm working on my third book, which is, it will be a game book for teenagers. It really will be for parents and teachers. So doing that with a guy named John Retker, who's a PhD psychologist who worked with teenagers and uses a mindfulness-based approach. So very excited about that. I think the question underscores the point that we've been discussing, which is that happiness is in the present moment, and we can achieve happiness through gratitude, acceptance, intention, and non-judgment. And so I would simply say that, yes, it's great to have goals, but let's not do away with the intentions in the present moment. So enjoy every moment, because the moment is all we really ever experience. And, you know, relegate the goals to maybe the middle burner, but focus on the intention that allows us to live in a positive way every moment, every day. And I think that's really just sort of a refocusing of one's thought processes toward orientation to the present moment through intentional living.
All right. So if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Dr. Greg Hammer, and we're talking about his book, Gain Without Pain, The Happiness Handbook. It's the happiest handbook for healthcare professionals, but I don't even feel like you need to add that. It's the happiness handbook. So stay with us. We're going to be right back. You're listening to Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers Network, and with me today is Dr. Greg Hammer. We're talking about his book, Gain Without Pain. And Greg, share a little bit about what the GAIN method is. You mentioned earlier that the acronym, and how can it be utilized when we are setting our intentions?
Sure, happy to do that, Alan. The GAIN method starts with a meditation. We can call it a contemplation or a contemplative meditation in the morning. And so I'll sort of walk you through that, and that might be a good way to frame the four pillars that constitute the acronym GAIN. So we wake up in the morning, we open the blinds, we do our morning hygiene thing, and then we find a comfortable place to sit, and we're going to do a 3-minute meditation. Now, I should say that many people have been told or understand that meditation needs to be done a commitment for a 30-minute session where we're sitting possibly in an uncomfortable position with our right ankle behind our left ear, and we're not allowed to move or have any thoughts. So I want to dispel that notion right now. What I'm talking about is actually it's a contemplative, intentional meditation. I'm actually going to suggest things for one to think about. So you can focus your thoughts. The goal is not to have no thoughts. And there's really no such thing as failure. So we have a seat, we get comfortable, we close our eyes, we begin to focus on the breath, which I think is the basis of meditation in general. And it's always there, always accessible. And what we're going to do is associate our breath with these GAIN elements. And so we can always go back to the breath, whether we're walking down the hall or driving in our car. And these elements will come back to us and remind us about our intentions. So we start with a very slow breath. We're going to slow it down and take a nice deep breath through our nose, maybe to a count of three, pause to a count of three, and then let the breath go without effort to a count of four. And by slowing the breath down, we slow our heart rate, we lower our blood pressure, we decrease the amount of adrenaline in our body. So we do this a few times. And then we move toward contemplating that for which we're grateful. So I can tell you, for example, that I was diagnosed with a kind of blood cancer about 10 years ago. Mm. I felt very unwell. Fast forward to the present time, I take an immunotherapy pill every day, and there's no evidence of this leukemia in my body. So that to me is something that comes first. The fact that I'm here breathing today, as my friend Doug would say, on the good side of the grass, is something for which I'm immediately grateful. And then I contemplate the loved ones in my life and how grateful I am for them, how grateful I am to live in a safe, comfortable environment, how grateful I am to have the privilege of working with children at Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford and serving these families and children. It's really just such a privilege. And I'm so grateful I went through the processes to get me here to be able to do this well. And so those are some things for which I'm grateful. And I sort of focus my energy and my attention on those. And then we transition to acceptance. And this is an acknowledgement that life has pain as well as happiness. It's, I think they're sort of equal in magnitude in many ways. And there's a formula in my book, which is suffering equals pain times resistance. Suffering equals pain times resistance. So the pain is there. And the first thing that comes to me personally, and others will have their own pain points, but I lost my beautiful boy at the age of 29, 4 years ago. So that's obviously a very painful experience. And the more I resist it, that means try not to think about it, try to explain it away, try to butt up against it. There are many ways to resist painful thoughts and experiences, but the more I resist it, the more I suffer. I found that if I sit and I'm breathing slowly and I've gone through my gratitude contemplation and I now feel my chest opening and I envision my heart opening and I take this painful thought and experience of my son's passing and I bring it closer and closer and closer until it enters my chest. It merges with my heart. It merges with my soul. And it's part of me. And as I breathe slowly, I feel my muscles relax and I fully embrace and accept this pain. If I ask myself the question, can I live with this pain forever? The answer is yes. So at that point, I know that there's no separation, that I've really fully taken this pain in and embraced it and accepted it. And again, you know, if we lower our resistance to the pain, our suffering diminishes. So theoretically, if we became fully accepting of the pain, there would be no suffering associated with it. I think maybe that's a state of bliss that is rare, but I think there are many examples of individuals who may have actually been able to accept the pain in life to that degree that their suffering has vanished. Mm-hmm. So we can contemplate other painful things that we cannot change, as the Serenity Prayer would have us understand. We need to discern between what we can change and what we cannot change, and accept that which we cannot change. So we're not going to lie down and be trod upon by everybody with bad intentions. No, not at all. That's not what acceptance is. If we can change something for the better, we commit ourselves to that. If we can't, then we accept it and we practice this acceptance, because it takes practice. Our initial reflex is to resist painful things, to try to walk the other way. So when we can't walk the other way, then we open our hearts and accept it. We then transition to intention. And intention means living purposefully. One of my heroes in life, Alan, is Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's really the founder of mindfulness practice. And Dr. Kabat-Zinn defined mindfulness as awareness of the present moment non-judgmentally, on purpose. So it's purposeful, that's intentional. Being aware of the present moment intentionally without judgment. And we can do this. As I said, I think one of the ways our brains are wired that veils our happiness, apparently, is that we're fixated on the past and future. But the good news is, through intention, we can focus on the present and be happier. And one terrific example of this is a program at Duke University called Three Good Things. Okay. And the Three Good Things program, they've had many, many thousands of people enroll in this online. basically, it's distilled down to a commitment to consider three positive things that happen during the day as we prepare to go to sleep at night. And if you're a journaler, write them down. I have trouble doing that, so I just think of them. And what they've shown is that in thousands and thousands of subjects, simply thinking of three good things that happen during the day makes us sleep better and makes us happier. Now, how simple is that?
Yeah.
You know, it's a simple representation of what intention can do. Simply in purposefully adopting this three good things practice takes no time. You can have the three good things thoughts when you're turning down the bed linens, etc. You know, I can say for me, you know, it's a bit cloudy and cool outside today, but it's still a beautiful day. I will definitely include our conversation, Alan, this morning as one of my good things for today. It's been really great meeting you. I can say that already. And there's other good things ahead. I look forward to a bike ride, etc. So this is intention, and this applies to every moment. Simply living with purpose and thinking of things in a more positive and present-oriented way is one example. So now we're in our gain meditation. We've embraced three good things, perhaps, and reinforce that we can live with purpose and intention and be happier. And then we go to non-judgment. And I think this is just another, I think all four elements are so interesting and we could spend days talking about each one, but you know, our minds are constantly comparing everything in our environment and making judgments. So, and this combined with our negativity bias leads to a lot of negative, harsh self-judgment. And again, everyone listening should know that they are not alone in this. We are all this way. It's the way our brains are wired. So we're always thinking, well, you know, I'm smarter than that person, or, you know, he's better looking than I am, or, you know, this is better than that. And the fact is, there's really nothing gained by assigning all of these adjectives. We don't need to judge things on our environment. We can just enjoy them exactly as they are. And again, this is where the gain elements are interrelated. There's acceptance sort of interwoven with non-judgment because we accept things the way they are without resistance. We don't judge them. So for me, in my gain meditation, I've thought of the gratitude of my work, of my loved ones, of my health. I've accepted the loss of my son and other issues in my life and found myself able to relax into them and open my heart and embrace them. I've reminded myself of my intention to be present and more positive. And with the non-judgment, I actually picture one of these beautiful NASA images of the Earth and remind myself that the Earth is neither good nor bad. There's no judgment applicable. The Earth is just beautiful ball of land and ocean and all these beautiful people and animals, and it just is the way it is. It's neither good nor bad. And then I'm led to look at myself and realize it's only logical to apply the same standard to myself. I am neither good nor bad. I am just myself. And with this, we breathe deeply, and then we transition to a couple of more deep breaths and then slowly open our eyes and we're ready to go out into the world.
So let me jump to another question. So we've got another, this is a listener question that has come in. This one reads, my father was an orthopedic surgeon who cared very much for his patients. He used to come home and tell us about his patients. It seems they were all special in some way to him. My son is just finishing medical school and will be starting his residency next year in San Francisco. I know he is very apprehensive about how drastically things have changed since the pandemic has hit. I'm buying your book for him as I believe it might help settle him down about the challenges ahead. Can you weigh in on this and what advice you would give him or other young people like him?
That's a beautiful story and a great question. It reminds me that I was on the faculty amongst a group of other intensive care physicians recently where we were doing a boot camp. We had pediatric intensive care fellows from all over the country going through this course for 3 days at Stanford. And one of the participants asked, what's the one piece of advice you would give to help us cope with the stresses of fellowship? And people, other faculty members said, well, you know, here's what I think about how you should maintain a good relationship with your spouse or your girlfriend or boyfriend. And others weighed in differently on how to practice or, you know, how to be a fellow. And my comment was that I hope you will all consider embracing a mindfulness practice. And I explained why I felt that way briefly. And later in the day, I overheard some of the other faculty basically saying what a dumb thing to say that was. And I sort of laughed. But that was about 2 or 3 years ago, actually. And over the intervening time, whenever I think of that, I'm even happier that I said that, because that would be my advice today as well. So I think, first of all, with regard to changes in medicine, I have to say that it's a fantastic career. We can find great happiness through the practice of medicine. There are two kinds of happiness in general. One is called hedonic happiness, and that comes from self-limited, pleasurable experiences like having a great meal or buying a new car or having a great vacation. Those things come and go. The more enduring kind of happiness is eudaimonic happiness, and that comes from service. That comes from helping others, really. And medicine is a great way to do that. So I think it's a great career. I have to say that the sky has been falling in medicine ever since I started medical school, that people have been saying, oh, things are changing. It's not going to be such a great career anymore. Our salaries are going down, this and that. And despite that, I think that getting admitted to medical school is as competitive as ever. And mm-hmm. So I applaud the listener for having a son that was accepted into medical school and residency. And again, I would give the same advice. First of all, I would say medicine is a fantastic career. And even during the pandemic, it's a fantastic career. Obviously, there's been a lot of stress, which is depending on where one practices. It's not as though every hospital has been overwhelmed with COVID, but yes, it has added to probably the prevalence of burnout, and it's another layer of stress in many ways. But medicine, despite that, is a great, great, great career. And my advice would be, well, I'm honored that you bought the book for your son, and that would contain my advice, which is basically to focus on a way to be present. Because, of course, medical school has been very stressful, and residency will be too, and so will fellowship after that, if there is a fellowship, and so will practice. So all the better reason to start now to developing a way to be present, and I think the game approach is as good as any. And so, thank you for getting your son the book, and if they're going to be at Stanford, let me know. I'd love to buy him a cup of coffee.
There you go. And I think I'd like to take this time also just to thank a lot yourself and a lot of the healthcare professionals. I know that, it's now been, a year and a half ago or so, when the pandemic started, and we didn't know. There were so many things we didn't know. And yet, my personal doctor and so many other people that I know, friends whose husbands or wives are nurses or doctors. There's so many things we didn't know, but they were there for us. And I'm so grateful and so thankful that so many people out there, without knowing really what we were dealing with, put themselves out there because of the oath that they took to help other people. And again, I'm very thankful for that.
Well, thank you, Alan, for acknowledging that. I'm honored to be able to step it up during this period and pitch in.
Okay. And we have another question. We've got about 4 minutes left. Time has flown by, but I've loved it. This question says, these days, the majority of us are members of HMOs or PPOs and a nurse friend who works in the same system of which I am a member of said the doctors are under tremendous pressure to see as many patients as possible, limiting their time to 10 minutes or less. She said that all of the doctors and upper level nursing staff spend about 80% of their time filling out paperwork and forms rather than taking care of patients. I'm very curious to what your view of HMOs and the quality of care is.
Great question. I'll first of all say that in the WellMD program, we have a rubric that really describes professional fulfillment, but also potentially burnout. And so if you think of a pie cut in thirds, there are three domains that that can lead to professional fulfillment or burnout. And they include, one is the culture of medicine. And so the culture of the place where we work is extremely important. You know, we need to be all accepting and acknowledge that some people need psychological help and so on. And this has not been the way medicine, the culture of medicine has been. So things are moving in the right direction, but that those elements are certainly very important. The second one of the three domains is efficiency of practice. Mm-hmm. And yes, a lot of clinic physicians, for example, are extremely frustrated because we all feel a lot of metrics applied to us all the time. You know, these outside agencies come in and they assess our practice. The administrators are looking at various benchmarks, how many patients we see, how satisfied our patients are. For a lot of clinic physicians, they're being told to see more patients every hour. And of course, there aren't the treatment rooms and staff to turn those rooms over and get the patients out of the waiting room into a room. And there's just not the support for that. And also, it's unrealistic to expect that physicians are going to see more than, you know, six patients an hour even. It's just incredible to me. So there's inefficiency there, and that's a big source of unhappiness, the efficiency of practice. And the third domain is personal resilience, which is where I'm hoping to make a difference. But I think this is just the way it is in medicine. It's not limited to medicine. I think similarly, you know, margins for corporations have become very narrow, the airline industry, mm-hmm. et cetera. And so everybody is under a lot of pressure to perform. I think it's just a reality. I think it's something... some of us can work toward changing by working with the administration. I think the incidence of burnout related to culture, efficiency, and resilience is at an all-time high. And the administrators are starting to really pay attention because there are a lot of costs of burnout, including negative patient outcomes and physician suicide among them. So I think this is getting the attention of the administrators. But in the meantime, we have to work with the system we have. It's not just HMOs and PPOs. It's just generally the way medicine has gone. We still have a good healthcare system. I think we can, many of us feel fortunate to have access to it, but yes, there are some difficult and very stressful components to our system.
Well, unfortunately we've got about 30 seconds or so. If I handed you a magic wand real quick, as it relates to this subject, being burnout with healthcare people, what would you do, be it to change either a law or just miraculously make a change that would be for the better?
Wow. Do I only get one, Alan?
No, you get two.
Well, again, for personal resilience and professional fulfillment, I would say that, you know, the GAIN approach or mindfulness practice in general and rewiring the brain and all the things we've talked about, I wish everybody would be on board with that. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I think there's so many things we could do to make our healthcare system better. That's a whole topic for the next show, I suppose.
Well, yeah, exactly. And you said you've got another book coming out. I'd love to have you back. So I think there's so many things we could go through. Thank you for taking your time to write this. Thank you for looking out for those people that are looking out for us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Alan. It's been such a great pleasure. It's, as I said, definitely on my three good things list for tonight is getting to know you a little bit and being invited to participate.
Well, thank you. And it will be in my meditation as well, but I have one that I do as I go to sleep and one that I do as I wake up. So
beautiful.
All right. For everybody out there, please be sure to join us next Monday when Cynthia Fisher, founder of the Patients' Rights Advocate, we'll be back with us to provide an update on the successes and challenges now that healthcare price transparency has become law. While some healthcare organizations are resisting, 90% of the Americans want the costs known and available because it promises to create competition, reduce costs of care, reduce insurance costs for patients, and increase the amount of care that we get. So please plan on being with us. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network. You know, there's plenty of shows in there that you can listen to. You can go in, you can type in whatever keyword you want, and the odds are, after 12 years, we have a show that's going to be able to help you. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
Hello, I'm Marty Cove. You might remember me from roles such as Sensei in the Karate Kid films. I've done over 100 films and countless stunts in my career, and I've always given 100%. With the damage done to my body over time, I needed to find relief from my chronic pain. My passion for health and fitness drove me to find a natural way to combat muscle pain. Teaming up with doctors, detectives, and a compounding pharmacist, we've created Marty's Cobra Cove Ultra Strength CBD Cream. It's the only thing that has been strong enough to knock out my pain, and fast. Honestly, you may have tried the rest, but it's time to try the best. It's legal, it's safe, and 100% effective. Show your pain no mercy. Go to www.martyscobracove.com.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.